Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Welcome to another edition of As It Is. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You've come to the right place to learn and improve your American English skills. Today we have two stories for you that concern technology. First, we will hear from Iran. The government has a new plan to make sure that its citizens can visit only certain places on the Internet. Then, the robots are coming. No, not to take over the Earth, as in a science fiction movie, but maybe to change how some people in China earn a living. This is VOA, and we are happy to have you with us. Here is part one. For years, officials in Iran have talked about building what they call a halal Internet, an Internet for Iranians completely separate from the rest of the world. Recently, government officials in Iran unveiled a new measure in their continuing effort to monitor where its citizens can and cannot go online. It is an Iran-only search engine called Yooz. Jonathan Evans tells us about it.
Yooz is the Persian word for cheetah. Iranians, especially young Iranians, are big Internet users. Western-based search engines like Google, Bing, and Yahoo are very popular. But Yooz is designed to be the opposite of those sites. Officials say Yooz will perform searches of Iran-based and Persian-language websites. Mehdi Naghavi is the Minister for Information and Communications Technology. He oversees Yooz. Mr. Naghavi says the search engine will collect search information for users to make searches faster and more secure. Mr. Naghavi says Yooz will, in his words, help Iranians circumvent the U.S.-led economic sanctions and grant the academic world the access to the Persian cyberspace. Iranian officials monitor Internet traffic in and out of Iran closely. Yooz is the latest tool to filter out material and websites the government finds objectionable. Officials are constantly blocking new websites created by free speech activists. During national elections and sensitive times, they even slowed down Internet traffic, leaving users frustrated. Some technology experts doubt Iran's claims of building a completely separate national Internet. They say Iran has built what they call a filter net, a heavily censored and filtered Internet. British Small Media is a web analysis company. In a recent report, it states that Iran is investing in a filter net and has doubled the budget for information and communications technology in just a few years. The report also states that popular websites and applications, such as Instagram and WhatsApp, are being blocked more frequently. Critics argue whether it is even possible for a country to turn back once it is connected to the Internet. Egypt and Syria tried to block the Internet during sensitive times. Both countries found the effects of blocking its citizens from the Internet even more damaging. China's Great Firewall is the largest web filtering and censorship operation in the world. Chinese officials use it to filter objectionable speech while permitting the free flow of international trade. But even that system is not foolproof. Internet users in China can still circumvent filters from the government using Tor, VPNs, and Siphon to hide their activities. But it is clear that Iranians should not use Use if they want to search the entire Internet. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. A major manufacturing company employs workers in China to make iPads and iPhones. Now, the Honhai company plans to replace many workers with robots. Both economists and labor rights groups are welcoming the move. They say it will save the company money and ease workplace disputes. Kelly Jean Kelly has more.
The Honhai Company is based in Taiwan and operates factories in China. The U.S. company Apple and other top electronic brands hire Honhai to make products, including iPads and iPhones. The CEO of Honhai is Terry Go. Mr. Go recently told reporters that Honhai is replacing 70% of its manufacturing process with an automatic system. He says machines will do most of the work that people do now. Mr. Go expects the changes to be finished in 3 years. Jamie Wong is a researcher with a business in Taipei that studies markets. She says using robots is an increasingly common change in manufacturing. Even the popular company Apple is planning to depend more on robots, she says. So, she says, manufacturers like Honhai must keep up with the market and reduce their costs. Using robots may also reduce Honhai's risk of labor disputes. In the past 5 years, some workers in Honhai's Chinese factories have protested workplace conditions and even killed themselves. The events have damaged the company. Now, fewer workers are depending on Honhai for jobs. Jeff Crothall is a spokesman for the China Labor Bulletin Advocacy Group in Hong Kong. He says people are no longer forming long lines to try to work in factories. He says some Chinese workers are staying in school longer and seeking higher levels of education. Others are simply finding better jobs in other places. Companies such as Honhai are also facing rising wages for factory work in China. Those wages rose 13% in 2014. At the same time, the cost of living in eastern China is increasing. Some workers are moving to less expensive but less developed cities. And foreign investments, especially in manufacturing, are slowing. Direct investments grew at only 2% last year. Liang Guyen is chairman of the Uinta Polaris Research Institute in Taipei. He says companies as large as Honhai need to bring more machines into their manufacturing process. He says the company must move toward automatic systems as costs rise and the number of workers drops. Honhai refused VOA requests for details on its plans, but the company has said it hopes to grow in the United States. It also says it wants to open a $1 billion research and development center in Indonesia. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Jimmy Jean Tedder. Sorry, I couldn't resist. You are listening to The Voice of America, and this is Learning English.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Our bodies react to daylight. In fact, light is the most powerful environmental signal for resetting our biological clock. Part of the job of the biological clock is to control when we sleep and when we wake. Light has a similar effect on a common insect, the fruit fly. So says Logan Roberts, a PhD student at the University of California, Irvine. He was the lead writer of a report on the subject. A long flight can affect one's biological clock, sometimes for days. Air travelers can get very tired and develop unpleasant feelings when they fly great distances across time zones. The natural order of things can become unbalanced on long overseas trips, from east to west or from west to east. In experiments, Logan Roberts and other researchers removed the brains of genetically engineered flies. The insect's genes were changed for the purpose of this study. The researchers kept the brains alive in a laboratory. They used bursts of light to change their circadian rhythm by 2 hours. A circadian rhythm is a 24-hour cycle, a series of events or actions that happen in the same order, over and over again. This natural system tells our bodies when to sleep and helps to control many other processes. This internal body clock is affected by environmental signals, like sunlight and temperature. The researchers studied how the brains of the fruit flies reacted. Mr. Roberts says that by using a low-light sensitive camera, they could see activity in individual neurons.
The activity is measured by the amount of light these single neurons emit. They have firefly gene engineered into these flies so that when these cells are active, they actually literally light up in the brain, and we can measure that activity.
The new report was published in the journal Current Biology. The study is the first to document, in real time, how neurons react to changes in lighting, like those affecting the jet-lagged traveler. Logan Roberts uses the word desynchronized when talking about the study and jet lag. This means to cause a process that takes place at times or in cycles independent of another process. In unscientific terms, you might say out of sync or out of whack. In this state of desynchronization, he adds, communication between some neurons weakens. He says using light to temporarily reset your biological clock before you travel could help to reduce symptoms when you arrive at your final stop. Mr. Roberts says the model used to study jet lag in fruit flies can be used in the study of other human conditions. He says that when our body clock is out of sync, we can be at greater risk for diabetes, cancer, and diseases of the nervous system. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In September of 1901, President William McKinley was assassinated. His vice president, Theodore Roosevelt, was sworn in to replace him. Roosevelt was 42 years old, the youngest man ever to hold the office of President of the United States. This week in our series, Morris Joyce and Shep O'Neill tell the story of President Theodore Roosevelt and his administration.
Theodore Roosevelt became president at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of rapid changes in American society. The changes were a result of technology. Great progress had been made, for example, in transportation. Almost every American city had a street railroad or trolley. These systems were powered by electricity. Thousands of Americans owned automobiles, and Henry Ford was planning a low-cost version which even more people could buy. Great progress had been made in communications. There were telephones in almost every business office in the cities and in many homes. And Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi had sent the first wireless message across the Atlantic Ocean.
It was clear that the United States had made great progress in technology. Yet many believed it had made little progress in social issues. These people felt America's natural resources were being misused. They felt America's farmers were poorer than they should be. They felt America's industries were unfair to workers. Since the late 1800s, a spirit of reform had been growing in the United States. It started among farmers and led to the creation of a new political party, the Populists. Then organized labor joined the movement. Then middle-class Americans. Not everyone agreed on ways to solve society's problems, but they were united in the belief that social progress had to be made. The future of American democracy, they said, depended on the success of the progressive movement. The man who came to represent the spirit of reform most of all was the new president, Theodore Roosevelt.
Roosevelt was born to a wealthy family in New York City in 1858. He was a weak child with poor eyesight. He spent much of his time reading. When Theodore was 13 years old, he got into an argument with two other boys. He tried to fight them, but he was not strong enough. That incident was a turning point in Roosevelt's life. He decided to overcome his physical weaknesses through exercise and hard work. He lifted weights, ran long distances, and learned how to be a boxer. He continued these activities while he attended Harvard University. After college, Roosevelt married Alice Lee and returned to New York. He became active in the Republican Party. When he was just 23 years old, he was elected to the state legislature. Roosevelt quickly became known as a reform politician. He denounced all forms of dishonesty in government.
Roosevelt's first political career did not last long. He withdrew after 4 years, following the deaths of his wife and mother. His sadness was so great that he could not continue. Roosevelt moved to a ranch in the Dakota Territory of the American West. He began to raise beef cattle. At first, the local cowboys laughed at him. They called him Four Eyes because he wore eyeglasses. They stopped laughing when they found he could do the hard work of a cowboy as well as any of them.
Roosevelt spent 2 years in the West. Then he returned to New York and a life in politics. He became the Republican candidate for mayor of New York City, but lost the election. Then he campaigned for Republican Benjamin Harrison in the presidential election of 1888. Harrison won. And he named Roosevelt head of the Federal Civil Service Commission. Roosevelt fought hard to keep politics out of the civil service. Democrat Grover Cleveland was elected president 4 years later. He approved of Roosevelt's civil service reforms. He asked him to remain in the job. Roosevelt did so for another 2 years. Then he became commissioner of police in New York City. Once again, he pushed for reforms. He removed policemen found guilty of receiving illegal payments.
In 1897, President William McKinley named Theodore Roosevelt Assistant Secretary of the Navy. The United States went to war against Spain a year later. Roosevelt wanted an active part in the war, so he resigned and joined the army. He organized a force of horse soldiers known as the Rough Riders. They were honored for bravery in the Battle of San Juan Hill in Cuba. Roosevelt was now a war hero. Republican Party leaders in New York thought he would be the perfect candidate for governor. Teddy, as the public called him, won a close election. He soon made clear he would not take orders from party leaders. The new governor proposed controls on businesses. His main targets were companies that supplied the public with water, electricity, and natural gas. He demanded changes in the food and drug industries, and he shortened the workday for women and children.
The public praised Roosevelt's reform efforts. Local party leaders did not. As one said, "I do not want him raising hell in my state any longer." Local leaders decided the best way to get him out of New York politics was to support him for Vice President of the United States. The office gave a man very little voice or power in politics. Roosevelt did not want the job for that reason. By then, he wanted just one thing, to be President of the United States. He was sure being Vice President would ruin his chances. But he accepted the nomination at the National Convention. He would run on the ticket with William McKinley. "Sadly," he said, I do not expect to go any further in politics. Several months after he was sworn in as vice president, he was sworn in as president. William McKinley was dead. Theodore Roosevelt became president as the result of an assassin's bullet.
Roosevelt promised party leaders that he would continue McKinley's policies. He said he would move slowly in making any changes. In his first message to Congress, President Roosevelt offered a few new proposals. He asked for a Department of Commerce and Labor to deal with industrial problems. He called for a stronger Navy and for limits on immigration. And he proposed building a canal in Central America to link the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
Businessmen who feared the worst when Roosevelt became president began to breathe easier. It seemed he was not going to push for reforms after all. But Roosevelt was only following an old hunting rule of African tribesmen. Speak softly, the rule said, and carry a big stick. Roosevelt spoke softly during his first months as president. He would use the big stick later. When the blow came, it was against big business. A group of wealthy railroad owners had agreed to join their railroads into one. They formed a company to control it. The new company would have complete control of railroad transportation in the American West. There would be no competition.
President Roosevelt believed the company violated the Sherman antitrust law. The law said it was illegal for businesses to interfere with trade among the states. The law also said it was illegal for any person or group to get control of a whole industry. Since the antitrust law had been passed in 1890, few companies had been found guilty of violating it. So many people were shocked when Roosevelt announced he was taking action under the law against the railroad trust. He said there could be no compromise in how the law was enforced. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Morris Joyce and Shep O'Neill. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.